Welcome to the Mother-Daughter Best of Friends podcast with myself, Becky Measures, and my rather bonkers, not a day over fabulous, inspiring mummy, Wendy Watson, founder of the Hereditary Breast Cancer Helpline. Not only do we have the usual mum-girl-child relationship with a couple of grandkids thrown in, we are forever connected by our love of musicals, random scenarios, and a faulty breast cancer gene, BRCA1. Between us, we hope you relate to the madness of a typical, or maybe not so typical, mother-daughter relationship. We hope we create lots of laughs, but more importantly, we hope we inform and raise plenty of awareness of hereditary breast cancer, so that anyone who should need it has a breast friend in us. So welcome back to the Mum and Daughter Breast of Friends podcast. I think this is episode 3 now, isn't it?
Oh, I believe it is.
Yes. I think we're going to get to that point where we literally do lose count, but that doesn't matter. Thank you for joining us. As we said, you know, we're going to take you on many different journeys, I think, throughout this podcast. Not only do we want to entertain you, hopefully make you laugh, but also, of course, inform you along the way and give you as much awareness as we possibly can regarding hereditary breast cancer. Now, so far, you know, sort of during these episodes, we kind of touched basically on your journey and a little bit on mine, that, you know, you are the founder of the Hereditary Breast Cancer Helpline, mother.
That's correct, you have.
Yes. And also, you know, it was 30 years ago to the year this year, 2023, that you had a preventative double mastectomy.
Yes, that's right.
And
yes.
At that time as well, we weren't aware of anybody else that had had that done. And the idea came from yourself and from discovering that 9 out of 12 women in your family had had breast cancer.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm quite a reasonable problem solver, and this seemed to be a good solution.
Well, and so it has been, you know, and it has made a massive amount of difference. You know, we look how far we've come now with hereditary breast cancer. At the time when you were making that decision, no one was really talking about it. A lot of the medical profession didn't even know about it. So it was, you know, pioneering at the time. But obviously there was somebody that was very instrumental in everything that you've done.
Gareth, who we're about to speak to, has been pivotal from day one and until today. And he's quite a remarkable person, actually, as you will hear, because, bless him, he even answers queries from the helpline in the middle of the night. It's bizarre.
Well, you were obviously meant to be doing this together then, because, you know, you're obviously both as wappy as each other. No disrespect, Gareth, before we come to you. Do you know what I mean?
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Professor Gareth Evans. I wish I had a round of applause for him. Gareth, thank you for coming on and having a chat with us today. And, you know, hopefully this is going to be a regular thing, because I think there's going to be a lot of people that I'll have a lot of questions for you, and a lot of people that will get a lot of comfort from you. But are you all right? Do you mind if we go back to the beginning, Gareth?
Of course. I mean, that's where we should always start, at the beginning. So, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much. So, what, you know, I have grown up with the pair of you, and I suppose when I was when I was a kid and sort of watching all of this, I just saw these two people that were a bit nuts, to be fair, and, you know, they were going off and doing this, that and the other. But now, you know, I am that bit older and I can look back and go, wow, this is amazing. What's your official title, Gareth?
I'm a Professor of Medical Genetics and Cancer Epidemiology at the University of Manchester, and also a consultant at St Mary's, that's Manchester Foundation Trust, and the Christie Hospital in Manchester.
Wow, so that's quite a big title. So when Mum came to you 30 years ago, right, do you remember that day? Do you remember getting that call or getting that letter? What was the scenario?
I do remember it almost like yesterday. It was in the Nightingale Centre at Withington Hospital, where we ran our family history clinic. The family history clinic was set up in 1987 by Professor Tony Howell, and I joined him in January 1990. So I'd been seeing women with family history of breast cancer and organizing breast screening for them. We were in the process of setting up a trial for tamoxifen called IBIS-1, which was very successful in showing that you could reduce the risk of breast cancer by 35 to 40% by being on tamoxifen for 5 years. That's in women without breast cancer. So I was involved in counseling women about their risk, calculating their risk, telling them what their options were. But at the stage before I saw Wendy, it was very rare to discuss risk-reducing mastectomy. And in fact, I cannot remember for certain if I had mentioned it before Wendy coming along. Certainly, even in the year or so after Wendy came along, if I would mention it, women would often fall off the back of a chair. They were so shocked that it would even be discussed as an option. So, Wendy changed that whole situation dramatically, that it became the norm to talk about it and to give women that option. And sometimes it would be, you know, you would just discuss it. This is something that some women choose to do, and women would take it on board. And then 2 years later, they'd come back and say, you know, that option you discussed, I'd really want to go ahead with that. When I first saw your mum, Wendy, she came to me very matter of fact, went through the family tree, which was enormous, as we've heard, with so many women with breast cancer, and unfortunately so many dying of breast cancer. The BRCA1 gene had been linked on chromosome 17 in 1990, and the pattern with Wendy's mum also having ovarian cancer was really pretty compelling, that this was very likely to be due to BRCA1, but the gene itself hadn't yet been identified. So we were not able to offer a genetic test at the time to Wendy. In fact, just after she had the surgery, we were able to offer what we called a linkage test, which would show which women had inherited the faulty copy and the not faulty copy by tracking the chromosome. But it wasn't until October 94 that the gene was actually identified and we could actually find a spelling mistake. And in your family, it took many years after that, because the genetic change was not in the normal part of the gene. It was into what we call the intron. And it took a number of years to be able to identify that and be able to offer definitive testing in the family. But you're probably going to want to stop the diatribe at some point. But what I will say is, it was an incredible experience. No one had ever come to me with their own solutions. And it just seemed entirely logical to me. I mean, I made it very clear that, you know, Wendy was making up her mind on the basis of a 40 to 45% lifetime risk, because we didn't know whether Wendy had inherited the faulty copy. But we could at least say, look, there has to be a gene in your family. It's a 50-50 chance you've inherited it, and we don't know when we will have a test.
Just going back to that, though, Gareth, I mean, you know, again, we've lived through this, etc., but I still think, you know, it's sort of quite eye-opening for us to ask this question, to find these things out. It seems to me that you two were kind of destined to meet, because by what you're saying is that you had been working on this with Tony Howell, etc., and you'd been sort of discussing these options with people, but people were like, nah, I'm not doing this. Then randomly, you get this woman, right, that comes to you, that comes up with the same idea that you've been putting out there in the first place. I can imagine that was like, whoa, here it is.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't putting it out that much before, because when we did, we were getting, you know, quite a reaction to it. And there there had been quite a lot of risk-reducing mastectomies carried out in the United States. And there's been a big backlash against it in the United States. Say, you know, I think it was the Mayo Clinic in particular that published a very large series that they'd been doing over 20 years. And people were saying, well, why are you doing this? If you have rats and you irradiate them after mastectomy, they still get breast cancer. Well, women aren't rats. And we now know that that the risk reduction is, you know, is extremely good, 90 to 95%. 95% if the nipples are removed and you have nipple reconstruction with a skin sparing mastectomy, and probably if you go the whole hog, which is to remove most of the skin, which obviously isn't to every woman's taste because cosmetically it isn't so good, you're probably up to a 98-99% reduction. But at the time, there was still this big debate, oh, will it work? You know, because, well, it doesn't work in rats that you give radiation to. Well, that's not really a good model.
No, exactly. Like you say, women are not rats. So you get this lady, you get this Wendy Watson, and, you know, she goes and she wants to have this surgery, but then at that point as well, that wasn't that simple, was it?
No, because really there weren't surgeons doing it in the UK, so it was a first for most surgeons. I only know of one other couple of sisters who had surgery with a fairly maverick surgeon who basically told them, oh, your family history, in fact, it was another family very similar with BRCA1, and we were eventually able to offer tests. And both those sisters, who actually were told, you have to have this surgery, they weren't given a choice.
Oh, right.
They both said this to me. They were told, look, you're going to get breast cancer, I might as well just lock them off for you.
Wow.
And they didn't have good cosmetic results, but they lived for... I think, another 15 or 16 years after the surgery, thinking, at least I've got rid of the risk. Unfortunately, to then find out, they didn't actually have the BRCA1 gene fault in their family. So, So in the end, you know, certainly Wendy was the first with BRCA1 to have the surgery, as far as I'm aware, in the UK.
Wow, I wondered, like, you know, this is always something that sort of crossed my mind, is like, what happened next? Who were the next people? Because we've talked to Mum about this, and Mum's been very open that when she had her surgery and she woke up, she felt like the most liberated woman ever. She just felt relief. And then, obviously, you know, she was very involved with yourself. She even told us that you gave her some of the teaching papers to look at because she needed the knowledge. I mean, what must have been going through your mind then? I bet you, I mean, at that point, you probably knew her better then, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was just so logical. It felt that, you know, that someone knew exactly what they were doing, knew exactly why. And it was just logical. And it did change my practice. And it changed our practice in Manchester, because we felt we had to offer all women at high risk of breast cancer at least a discussion, at least an opportunity to discuss this. And of course, that became NICE guidance in 2003, that all women at high risk should be able to have a discussion about risk-reducing mastectomy. In fact, be offered risk-reducing mastectomy as an option. So it's quite a strong positive.
Mm.
But of course, you know, by 2003, there was already strong evidence from the Mayo Clinic write-up that surgery worked. You know, it was at least a 90 to 95% reduction in risk. So we were then on much firmer grounds. But, you know, in Manchester, we developed a protocol, published our protocol in 1995, so not long after Wendy's surgery. And we were then in the situation where, you know, women no longer had to push for it themselves. And I think it's very difficult for a woman to, you know, go up to medical people and say, look, I want to have this done.
The thing is, and it's the same with anything, isn't it, is that, you know, you stick to what you're good at. You're trained in the things that you know about. So when somebody is a medical expert, right, and they're telling you to do one thing, you want to believe it, and you kind of have to believe it because that's their, that's what they do. So if you're coming up with this idea yourself, it's almost sort of a Dr. Google incident, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Will you be believed? Will you come across stupid because you don't have that training?
Yeah, it's exactly that, and that's why very few women would, even if they're fairly convinced, come forward with it. And I think Wendy has come across people who have not had it discussed and felt they weren't given the opportunity to have it discussed. Less so nowadays because it is enshrined in NICE guidance, but. There is still a very significant proportion of the medical profession who think it's abhorrent to do the operation.
Oh, really?
And they don't like having to offer it because they think it's wrong to take away healthy breast tissue. But of course, you can argue that actually, with one faulty copy of BRCA1, it's not that healthy breast tissue because there are almost certainly cells within those breasts, certainly by the 20s and 30s, that have already lost the normal copy of the gene, and they are very unhealthy breast cells by that point.
Wow. It's like there's you get over so many hills and have so many breakthroughs, but then there's still many things that you've got to get through, isn't it? And that you've got to get over. You would just think by now that, you know, 30 years down the line and with everything that we know and sort of how common knowledge it is, that you wouldn't have to break those barriers still.
Well, I think there are still people that would say that actually, if you have really good screening with MRI scans, that you know even with an 80%+ risk of breast cancer, that you'll get your breast cancer, but you will probably survive it, and that therefore the difference in survival or mortality is not dramatic if you have that really good screening. But with BRCA1, virtually all of those women are going to have chemotherapy because these are nearly always high-grade, triple-negative breast cancers that require chemotherapy. So even with MRI, a BRCA1 carrier is looking at, you know, when am I going to get the diagnosis? And that diagnosis is going to mean I'm probably going to have chemotherapy.
So you're a ticking time bomb. It's as simple as
exactly,
that's what would be in my head. Yeah.
And so for many women, it's not about survival necessarily. It's about not wanting to have to get that diagnosis.
It's about living.
And have to go through chemo. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know when I came up with the idea, it was almost a throwaway idea because it's interesting that you should say you were already talking about tamoxifen with Tony. I heard in 1990 when tamoxifen was first allowed or published as being a treatment for breast cancer, and I thought, oh, well, I wonder if that could help prevent it. So I went to the doctor. This was the first thing I did, was go to the doctor and said, well, what about if I could go on tamoxifen? I've heard it on Jimmy Young. And would that help prevent it? He really did think I'd gone round the bend. And he said, well, no, that's, you know, it's a new drug and it's there to treat cancer. We've no idea about it being used as a prevention. So that was dismissed instantly. And it was then that I just came up with the idea, well, you know, this has got to be prevented somehow. And the only way I can think of is, we'll just have to have the surgery before we get it. Because I'm a very much of a control freak, and I could not cope with this going every 3 months for a check because mammograms weren't efficient then, probably not now, for dense young breast tissue. But I thought, well, well, I've got to do something. Best thing to do is to just get rid of the risk, and then we can just get on with life and enjoy it.
So for you, Gareth, having heard what you were saying sort of beforehand, for someone to come to you with that kind of that mindset must have been, you know, amazing, really, because you knew that this could be the breakthrough, maybe, that you needed.
Yeah, and I think there's no doubt that Wendy being so vocal and, you know, having the decision to have surgery with BRCA1, it really put it out there that this was an option and it was a viable option. And, you know, very quickly, Andy Beldam in Manchester developed really good techniques for reconstruction. And, you know, we had a proper program that we could offer women, you know, good reconstructive surgery where they, you know, they could have everything done in one go, albeit that, you know, sometimes you had to have a second small operation to put in final implants. But it completely changed things. And I'm not sure it would have gone into the NICE guidance in 2003 without, you know, what happened with Wendy and moving the dial completely, you know, that this was an acceptable option. It was feasible, and, you know, there were good operations that could be done that would leave many women, you know, pretty happy with the results of the surgery.
Amazing.
I think you're happy with your results,
Becky. Oh, just a little bit, yes. I've stopped getting them out as much as I used to, though, Gareth, right? You know, I've kind of got over that bit a little bit, but yeah, 100%. And it seems to me that, like, when you formed, you know, your team, really, you were all... It was like a missing jigsaw piece. And there's you, there's Tony, there's Andy Beldon, and then there's Mum, who's offering it from the sort of peer support side of things, from the patient side of things. It was like this: the bubble was completed. How did it feel to you when you heard, you know, other people in the medical profession doubting Mum and, you know, sort of saying to Mum, you know, this is ridiculous, you know, especially like with the Andrea and Rhonda situation when they wanted to have their surgery. How did that feel to you, knowing that this is somebody that is within your profession that is going against all of this?
Well, you know, as I said, at the time, certainly in the mid to late 90s, there was still a sizable proportion who doubted whether it would even work. And it just was illogical that, you know, if you're taking away 90 to 95% of the breast tissue, you should be reducing the risk by 90 to 95%. But there were people who thought, no, that wouldn't be the case. And, you know, it was very difficult without the longer term follow up, which we got from the Mayo Clinic data, to be able to say definitively, no, you're talking nonsense. We felt they were talking nonsense, but it wasn't until that data was available that we could say. And no, it was really remarkable that we were, you know, able to offer women who were desperate to do something, you know, where they either didn't have a gene test or, you know, in the mid to late 90s, we started to be able to do genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2. And TP53 is another example where the risks are really, really high. And if you've got a really, really strong family history, you know, your risks are way up towards 90% if you've inherited the gene fault. So, you know, going forward with knowing there's a 8 or 9 in 10 chance you're going to get breast cancer and not being able to do anything else about it, and even tamoxifen probably doesn't work that well in BRCA1 because it works to prevent estrogen positive tumors. And 70% of the tumors in BRCA1 are estrogen negative. So there's no really good evidence that it works in BRCA1.
It is
still like a massive minefield, isn't it? And I think, you know, do you feel like you're constantly learning and this is constantly sort of developing all the time?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why it's really important that we're still learning. We're still trying to give women as accurate information as possible so that they can make an informed choice that, you know, this is the likelihood. You know, we have programs now that can calculate your risk as a BRCA1 or BRCA2 carrier that incorporate your mammographic density. Wendy's already talked about that. If you have very dense breast tissue, that increases your risk. Looking at your other risk factors, like when you had your children, but also a new thing called polygenic risk, which is looking at hundreds of common genetic variants, which can alter the risk upwards or downwards if you're a BRCA1 carrier or a BRCA2 carrier or in the general population. It can have quite a big effect on your risk. And it means that we can, you know, tailor what women, you know, have available to them to their level of risk. And, you know, with this program, we are frequently getting women with risks over 90% who have BRCA1 or BRCA2.
Wow.
It really isn't uncommon.
I'm really looking forward to having a further podcast with you, Gareth, and, you know, go more in depth into a lot of this, because that is...
Definitely.
You know, that to me is kind of a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah.
I'm quite keen to incorporate here the fact that, yes, I was absolutely 100% sure what I was doing. I was astounded at the negative reactions that I kept getting from people saying, isn't that a bit drastic? And I just had one stock phrase, well, it's not actually as drastic as what happened to my mum. She was 6 foot under in her 40s. So to me, it's not drastic at all. But that's when I thought, well, what we've got to do is we've got to raise the awareness in a positive way, because when you do a magazine article, some of the nonsense that gets written is just not how you say it. So we did the decision program, which was it was impossible for her to be negative because it was me talking and me being filmed. So
indeed,
it was impossible. Mm. And then we decided that to raise the awareness even further, we would do, I'd always got a love of musicals and knew that you had. And that's when we decided that we'd do, Buxton Opera House did not do musical theatre. So in one day, I set up a theatre company called Performance. I got the rights to My Fair Lady. I rang you up and told you you were going to be Professor Higgins.
I didn't have a choice, man.
No,
this
no.
is Britney. We were going to get onto this actually, Gareth, because
it's my career defining role. I've also played him in Pygmalion as well. I've actually done the George Bernard Shaw version.
It was destined to be. So this is what I was going to get onto, because this is what is, you know, is so lovely. And I hope this always comes across within this podcast is that, yeah, you know, we're here to raise awareness and we're here to give people details, but we're also here to show them that, you know, as a whole, we are a family and, you know, how we operate and that we are approachable. And, you know, you've been part of my life since I was a kid. I think there was one point you were with us nearly every weekend. Do you know what I mean? And then you were involved in musicals and everything else. I want to say a massive thank you. I think, you know, on behalf of everybody, for everything that you do and, you know, for everything that you've done for us as a family and you and Mum combined, you know, you just are, you're a double act in yourself. You know what I mean? And I think thank you, Gareth, for putting up with her half at times. You know what I mean? Because I live with her, so
well,
I know.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure, honestly. It really has. And it's, you know, I mean, the whole thing about telling women about the option, the thing that made that change, because, as I said, the first few years, two or three out of 10 women would just almost fall off their chair at the thought of it being discussed as an option, and that disappeared. I never see that now. I've not seen it for 20 years. Women falling off their chair, or nearly falling off their chairs,
amazing,
as it were. proverbially. It just doesn't happen anymore.
It's just amazing. And you just think, like, you know, it was 30 years ago. That isn't long. Look how far you came in such a short period of time, really. But yeah. you were all of you. You know, I watched it first as a kid, and that, like I say, I can look back on it with fresher eyes now. I'm a bit older. You were all so invested. You were all so determined to make this change, to make this happen. And you blooming well did, you know. And there is still things that have got to be done. But, you know, I think you've just got to be proud of what has been achieved so far. And you've done it as a team.
Enhance your ability to feel and increase your sensitivity in a breast self-exam with the Aware Self-Examination Kit, available at awarebreastcheck.co.uk. Proud sponsors of the Mother and Daughter Breast to Friends podcast.
I've got to say, I'm delighted. If I've managed to change people's view of having surgery, that it's not a nightmare, it's not the end of the world, you're doing something that's really positive and helping yourself to save your life. And look how my life's gone on. I can't even tell you what I do, because it's just everything, all day, every day. And I think it's... I remember seeing a little clip from that Midland Report did, and me saying, I think I have a zest for life that possibly other people don't have. And that's because I used to have a cut-off point that's now gone. And that is what a privilege that is to experience that. Mm. So I'm just delighted when I make people feel okay about it. And, you know, the worst time they will feel is probably the night before and then afterwards. And everybody has come back and said, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And I think it was, well, you know, the team that there is in Manchester, you know, I particularly felt it. You're kind, and there's no judgment, and it's easy. And, you know, I know a lot of the work that all of you have been doing is to make sure that that is the case everywhere, because everybody should be treated like that. How busy would you say you are now, Gareth? How busy are the clinics? I mean, we know since the 30 years, Prevent has started, of course, in Manchester, which has just gone from strength to strength to strength. But are you massively inundated?
I mean, it goes in fits and starts. I mean, there are real triggers. I mean, for instance, at the discovery of BRCA1 and BRCA2, I think there was an exponential rise, so that we were getting well over 1,000 referrals a year for breast cancer family history. And then it sort of, I think, waned a little bit, partly because I think we'd sort of covered a lot of the women out there who had been worried for some time. And then there was a major resurgence when Angelina Jolie came forward with BRCA1 and talked about her surgery. And there was a major resurgence in referrals, which we published, and a major resurgence, in fact, in uptake of risk-reducing mastectomy. And it sort of stayed at quite a high level since then. So it certainly, I would say, the lowest referral time was when I think we'd got over the backlog of what was out there, and it had just lost a bit of steam, I guess, in the sort of, I would say, the sort of that Angelina Jolie came out and talked about it. So in the 10 years prior to that, it had sort of just leveled off a bit, and there wasn't quite so much interest. But yeah, no, things are busy. They remain busy. I'm not seeing as many as I used to. So we've got the new generation coming on, the new generation of Howells, Sasha Howell, because Professor Tony Howell has just had his fest trip, which is sort of the sort of academic sign-off of your career. So mine might not be too far away now.
Oh, no, we're not a day over fabulous. I can't see any of you ever stopping, that is for sure. And I think this is like, it sort of solidified to me as well. Like, you know, when we came up with the idea of doing this podcast, it just made sense to me. And, you know, you always know with anything, awareness is key, and getting that awareness out there is what's so important. But a lot of the time you have to rely on the media, and you have to rely on different forms of publicity in a respect. Whereas, you know, we need to do this. We need to keep telling people and keep making them aware. I think, you know, for this time, I'm so glad that you've agreed to be part of this, Gareth. Thank you so much. And you know, like Mum said, I'm hoping that you will be a regular on this, because I think there's so many things that are just a podcast in itself. But, you know, for now, for anybody that is listening right now and they sort of think, do you know what? My mum had it, or, you know, or my dad's mum had it, or whatever. What, apart from going to the helpline, which obviously we would always say is the first point of call, what else would you suggest for people to do, or would you advise for people to do?
It's worth. I mean, obviously, I would temper it slightly that if it's a very late onset, you know, granny in her 90s or even sort of 70s or 80s, and that's the only one in the family, I would really not worry about it too much. The risk is unlikely to be substantially increased. But we are now, I hope, pushing towards where for women in their early 30s, we should be doing some sort of breast cancer risk assessment. So if you have any strong risk factors, such as young onset breast cancer in the family, or other risk factors that you're aware of, you might have had breast biopsies that have had proliferative disease or things like that, then we should be doing more to identify women across the population at risk. So if you feel you're one of those women, you know, you can go to your GP and ask, can I be referred somewhere where I can have a risk assessment? The risk assessments are much more accurate nowadays. And with these additional tools that we have, such as measuring mammographic density, measuring the polygenic risk. So for most women, the polygenic risk is actually much more important than doing a test for BRCA1 or BRCA2.
Wow.
Obviously, for those that do have BRCA1 or BRCA2, that is trumps everything. But I don't want to flood GPs with the worried well with, you know, an elderly granny with breast cancer. But if you have a young onset close relative with breast cancer, or multiple relatives with breast and potentially ovarian cancer as well, then yes, you should get yourself risk assessed.
Fantastic. Well, obviously, like we say, the helpline is always available as well. And Gareth, thank you so much for coming on and having this initial chat with us. And like we say, we will be bothering you more. You will be hearing from Gareth, hopefully a lot more over the coming weeks. But thank you for joining us from your holiday.
No problem. From sunny France. Hey ho.
Yeah.